Left of the battlefield, some men were running away down the hill toward the canal. They were drab-dressed mercenaries, and as far as Philip could tell, it was the king's men who were fleeing, and the painted tribesmen of the attacking army who were in pursuit. The victorious whooping of the Welsh could be heard from here. Philip's hopes lifted. The rebels were winning already. Then there was a sea change on the other side. To the right, where the mounted men were engaged, the king's army seemed to be falling back. The movement was at first slight, then steady, then rapid, and even as Philip watched, the retreat turned into a rout, and scores of the king's men turned their horses and began to flee from the battlefield. Philip was elated. This must be God's will. Could it really be over so quickly? The rebels were advancing on both flanks, but the center was still holding steady. The men around King Stephen were fighting more fiercely than those to either side. Would they be able to stem the flow? Perhaps Stephen and Robert of Gloucester would fight it out personally. Single combat between two leaders could sometimes settle the issue, regardless of what was happening elsewhere on the field. It was not yet over. The tide turned with horrifying speed. At one moment the two armies were even, both sides fighting fiercely, and at the next the king's men were falling back fast. William was deeply disheartened. On his left, the Breton mercenaries were running away down the hill and being chased into the canal by the Welsh, and on his right, the earls with their war horses and banners were turning from the fight and trying to escape back toward Lincoln. Only the middle was holding. King Stephen was in the thick of it, laying about him with his massive sword, and the shiring men were fighting like pack wolves all around him. But the situation was unstable. If the flanks continued to retreat, the king would end up surrounded. William wanted Stephen to fall back, but the king was more brave than wise, and he fought on. William felt the entire battle take a lurch to the left. Looking around, he saw the Flemish mercenaries coming from behind and falling on the Welsh, who were forced to stop chasing the Bretons down the hill and turn to defend themselves. For a moment there was a melee. Then Ranulf of Chester's men, in the middle of the enemy front line, attacked the Flemish, who now found themselves squeezed between the men from Chester and the Welsh. Seeing the rally, King Stephen urged his men to press forward. William thought Ranulf might have made a mistake. If the king's forces could close with Ranulf's men now, Ranulf would be the one who was squeezed on two sides. One of William's knights fell in front of him, and suddenly he was in the midst of the fighting. A beefy northerner with blood on his sword lunged at him. William parried the thrust easily. He was fresh, and his antagonist was already tired. William thrust at the man's face, missed, and parried another jab. He raised his sword high, deliberately opening himself to a stab. Then, when the other man predictably stepped forward with another thrust, William dodged it and brought his sword down two-handed on the other man's shoulder. The blow split the man's armor and broke his collarbone, and he fell. William enjoyed a moment of elation. His fear had gone. He roared, "Come on, you dogs!" Two more men took the place of the fallen knight and attacked William simultaneously. He held them off, but he was forced to give ground. There was a surge on his right, and one of his opponents had to turn aside to defend himself against a red-faced man armed with a cleaver, who looked like a crazed butcher. That left only one for William to deal with. He grinned savagely and pressed forward. His opponent panicked and slashed wildly at William's head. William ducked and stabbed the man in the thigh, just below the fringe of his short mail jacket. The leg buckled and the man fell. Once again William had no one to fight. He stood still, breathing hard. For a moment he had thought the king's army was going to be routed, but they had rallied, and now neither side appeared to have the advantage. He looked to his right, wondering what had caused the surge that had distracted one of his antagonists. To his astonishment, he saw that the citizens of Lincoln were giving the enemy a hard fight. Perhaps it was because they were defending their own homes. But who had rallied them after the earls on that flank had fled? His question was answered. To his dismay, he saw Richard of Kingsbridge on his war horse, urging the townsmen on. William's heart sank. If the king saw Richard being brave, it could undo all William's work. William looked over at Stephen. At that moment the king caught Richard's eye and waved encouragement. William let out a resentful curse. The townsmen's rally relieved the pressure on the king, but only for a moment. To the left, Ranulf's men had routed the Flemish mercenaries, and now Ranulf turned toward the center of the defending forces. At the same time, the so-called disinherited rallied against Richard and the townsmen, and the fighting became furious. William was attacked by a huge man with a battle axe. He dodged desperately, suddenly afraid for his life. With each swing of the axe he leaped back, and he realized fearfully that the whole of the king's army was falling back at much the same pace. To his left, the Welsh came back up the hill and, incredibly, started throwing stones. It was ridiculous, but effective, for now William had to keep an eye out for flying rocks, as well as defend himself against the giant with the battle axe. There seemed to be a lot more of the enemy than before, and William felt, with a sense of despair, that the king's men were outnumbered. Hysterical fear rose in his throat, as he realized that the battle was very nearly lost, and he was in mortal danger. The king should flee now. Why was he fighting on? It was insane. He would be killed. They would all be killed. William's antagonist raised his axe high. William's fighting instincts took over for an instant, and instead of falling back as he had before, he leaped forward and lunged at the big man's face. His sword point went into the man's neck, just under the chin. William thrust it home, hard. The man's eyes closed. William felt a moment of grateful relief. He pulled the sword out and darted back to dodge the axe that now fell from the man's dead hands. He snatched a look at the king just a few yards to his left. As he looked, the king brought his sword down hard on a man's helmet, and the sword snapped in two like a twig. That was it, William thought with relief. The battle was over. The king would flee and save himself to fight another day. But the hope was premature. William had half turned, ready to run, when a townsman offered the king a long-handled woodman's axe. To William's dismay, Stephen grabbed the weapon and fought on. William was tempted to run away. Looking to his right, he saw Richard on foot, fighting like a madman, pressing forward, laying about him with his sword, striking men down left, right, and center. William could not flee when his rival was still fighting. William was attacked again, this time by a short man with light armor who moved very quickly, his sword flashing in the sunlight. As their weapons clashed, William realized he was up against a formidable fighter. Once again he found himself on the defensive and afraid for his life, and his knowledge that the battle was lost sapped his will to fight. He parried the rapid thrusts and slashes that were aimed at him, wishing he could get in the one strong blow that would smash through the man's armor. He saw a chance and swung his sword. The other man dodged and thrust, and William felt his left arm go numb. He was wounded. He felt sick with fear. He continued to fall back under the assault, feeling oddly unbalanced, as if the ground was shifting beneath him. His shield hung loose from his neck. He was unable to hold it steady with his useless left arm. The small man sensed victory and pressed his attack. William saw death and was filled with mortal dread. Suddenly, Walter appeared at his side. William stepped back. Walter swung his sword two-handed. Catching the small man by surprise, he cut him down like a sapling. William suddenly felt dizzy with relief. He put a hand on Walter's shoulder. "We've lost it!" Walter shouted at him. "Let's get out!" William pulled himself together. The king was still fighting even though the battle was lost. If only he would give up now and try to get away, he could return to the south and muster another army. But the longer he fought on, the greater the probability that he could be captured or killed. And that could mean only one thing. Maud would be queen. William and Walter edged back together. Why was the king so foolish? He had to prove his courage. Gallantry would be the death of him. Once again William was tempted to abandon the king. But Richard of Kingsbridge was still there, holding the right flank like a rock, swinging his sword and mowing men down like a reaper. "Not yet," William said to Walter. "Watch the king." They retreated step by step. The fighting became less fierce as men realized that the issue had been decided, and there was no point in taking risks. William and Walter crossed swords with two knights, but the knights were content to drive them back, and William and Walter fought defensively. Hard blows were struck, but no one exposed himself to danger. William stepped back two paces and chanced a look at the king. At that moment, a huge rock came flying across the field and struck Stephen's helmet. The king staggered and fell to his knees. William's antagonist paused and turned his head to see what William was looking at. The battle axe dropped from King Stephen's hands. An enemy knight ran to him and pulled off the helmet. "The king!" he shouted triumphantly. "I have the king!" William, Walter, and the entire royal army turned and ran. Philip was jubilant. The retreat started in the middle of the king's army and spread like a ripple to the flanks. Within a few heartbeats, the entire royal army was on the run. This was King Stephen's reward for injustice. The attackers gave chase. There were 40 or 50 riderless horses in the rear of the king's army, being held by squires, and some of the fleeing men leaped on them and made their escape, heading not for the city of Lincoln, but for the open country. Philip wondered what had happened to the king. The citizens of Lincoln were hurriedly leaving their rooftops. Children and animals were rounded up. Some families disappeared into their houses, closing the shutters and barring the doors. There was a flurry of movement among the boats on the lake. Some citizens were trying to get away by river. People began to arrive at the cathedral to take refuge there. At each entrance to the city, people rushed to close the huge iron-bound doors. Suddenly, Ranulph of Chester's men burst out of the castle. They divided into groups, evidently following a prearranged plan, and one group went to each city gate. They waded in among the citizens, striking them down to left and right, and reopened the doors to admit the conquering rebels. Philip decided to get off the cathedral roof. The others with him, mostly cathedral canons, had the same thought. They all ducked through the low doorway that led into the turret. There they met the bishop and the archdeacons, who had been higher up in the tower. Philip thought Bishop Alexander looked frightened. That was a pity. The bishop would need courage to share today. They all went carefully down the long, narrow spiral staircase, and emerged in the nave of the church at the west end. There were already 100 or so citizens in the church, and more pouring through the 3 great doorways. As Philip looked out, 2 knights came into the cathedral courtyard, bloodstained and muddy, riding hard, obviously having come from the battle. They rode straight into the church without dismounting. When they saw the bishop, one of them shouted, "The king is captured!" Philip's heart leaped. King Stephen was not just beaten, he was taken prisoner. The royalist forces throughout the kingdom would surely collapse now. The implications tumbled over one another in Philip's imagination, but before he could sort them out, he heard Bishop Alexander shout, "Close the doors!" Philip could hardly believe his ears. "No!" he shouted. "You can't do that!" The bishop stared at him, white with fear and panic. He was not sure who Philip was. Philip had made a formal call on him out of courtesy, but they had not spoken since. Now, with a visible effort, Alexander remembered him. "This is not your cathedral, Prior Philip, it's mine. Close the doors!" Several priests went to do his bidding. Philip was horrified at this display of naked self-interest by a clergyman. "You can't lock people out," he shouted angrily. "They might be killed." "If we don't lock the doors, we'll all be killed," Alexander screeched hysterically. Philip grabbed him by the front of the robe. "Remember who you are," he hissed. "We're not supposed to be afraid, especially of death. Pull yourself together."
"Get him off me!"
Alexander screamed. Several canons pulled Philip away. Philip shouted at them, "Don't you see what he's doing?" A canon said, "If you're so brave, why don't you go out there and protect them yourself?" Philip tore himself free. "That's exactly what I'm going to do," he said. He turned around. The big central door was just closing. He dashed across the nave. 3 priests were pushing it shut as more people fought to get through the narrowing gap. Philip squeezed out just before the door closed. In the next few moments, a small crowd gathered in the porch. Men and women banged on the door and screamed to be let in, but there was no response from inside the church. Suddenly, Philip was afraid. The panic on the faces of people locked out scared him. He felt himself trembling. He had encountered a victorious army once before at the age of 6, and the horror he had felt then returned to him now. The moment when the men-at-arms had burst into his parents' house came back as vividly as if it had happened yesterday. He stood rooted to the spot and tried to stop shaking, while the crowd boiled around him. It was a long time since he had been tormented by this nightmare. He saw the bloodlust on the men's faces, and the way the sword had transfixed his mother, and the awful sight of his father's guts spilling out of his belly, and he felt again that uncomprehending, overwhelming, insane, hysterical terror. Then he saw a monk come through the door with a cross in his hand, and the screaming stopped. The monk showed him and his brother how to close the eyes of his mother and father, so that they could sleep the long sleep. He remembered, as if he had just awakened from a dream, that he was not a frightened child any more. He was a grown man and a monk. And just as Abbot Peter had rescued him and his brother on that dreadful day 27 years ago, so today the grown-up Philip, strengthened by faith and protected by God, would come to the help of those in fear of their lives. He forced himself to take a single step forward, and once he had done that, the second was a little less difficult, and the third was almost easy. When he reached the street that led to the West Gate, he was almost knocked over by a mob of fleeing townspeople, men and boys running with bundles of precious possessions, old people gasping for breath, screaming girls, women carrying squalling children in their arms. The rush carried him back several yards. Then he fought against the flow. They were heading for the cathedral. He wanted to tell them it was closed, and they should stay quietly in their own homes and bar the doors, but everyone was shouting and no one was listening. He progressed slowly along the street, moving against the flood of people. He had gained only a few yards when a group of 4 horsemen came charging along the street. They were the cause of the stampede. Some people flattened themselves against house walls, but others could not get out of the way in time, and many fell beneath the flailing hooves. Philip was horrified, but there was nothing he could do, and he dodged into an alleyway to avoid becoming a victim himself. A moment later the horsemen had passed by and the street was deserted. Several bodies were left lying on the ground. As Philip stepped out of his alley, he saw one of them move. A middle-aged man in a scarlet cloak was trying to crawl along the ground, despite an injured leg. Philip crossed the street, intending to try to carry the man, but before he got there, 2 men with iron helmets and wooden shields appeared. One of them said, "This one's alive, Jake." Philip shuddered. It seemed to him that their demeanor, their voices, their clothes, and even their faces were the same as those of the 2 men who had killed his parents. The one called Jake said, "He'll fetch a ransom. Look at that red cloak." He turned, put his fingers in his mouth, and whistled. A 3rd man came running up. "Take Redcoat here into the castle and tie him up." The 3rd man put his arms around the wounded citizen's chest and dragged him off. The injured man screamed in pain as his legs bumped over the stones. Philip shouted, "Stop!" They all stopped for a moment, looked at him and laughed. Then they carried on with what they were doing. Philip shouted again, but they ignored him. He watched helplessly as the wounded man was dragged off. Another man-at-arms came out of a house wearing a long fur coat and carrying 6 silver plates under his arm. Jake saw him and took note of the booty. "These are rich houses," he said to his comrade. "We ought to get into one of them, see what we can find." They went up to the locked door of a stone house and attacked it with a battle axe. Philip felt useless, but he was not willing to give up. However, God had not put him in this position to defend rich men's property, so he left Jake and his companions and hurried toward the West Gate. More men-at-arms came running along the street. Mingled with them were several short, dark men with painted faces, dressed in sheepskin coats and armed with clubs. They were the Welsh tribesmen, Philip realized, and he felt ashamed that he came from the same country as these savages. He clung to the wall of a house and tried to look inconspicuous. 2 men emerged from a stone house, dragging by the legs a white-bearded man in a skull cap. One of them held a knife to the man's throat and said, "Where's your money, Jew?"
"I have no money,"
the man said plaintively. Nobody would believe that, Philip thought. The wealth of the Jews of Lincoln was famous, and anyway, the man had been living in a stone house. Another man-at-arms came out dragging a woman by the hair. The woman was middle-aged and presumably the Jew's wife. The 1st man shouted, "Tell us where the money is, or she'll have my sword up her cunt." He lifted the woman's skirt, exposing her graying pubic hair, and held a long dagger pointing at her groin. Philip was about to intervene, but the old man gave in immediately.
"Don't hurt her. The money's in the back," he said urgently. "It's buried in the garden by the woodpile. Please, let her go."
The three men ran back into the house. The woman helped the man to his feet. Another group of horsemen thundered down the narrow street, and Philip flung himself out of the way. When he got up again, the two Jews had disappeared. A young man in armor came down the street, running for his life, with three or four Welshmen in pursuit. They caught him just as he drew level with Philip. The foremost pursuer swung with his sword and touched the fugitive's calf. It did not seem to Philip like a deep wound, but it was enough to make the young man stumble and fall to the ground. Another pursuer reached the fallen man and hefted a battle axe. With his heart in his mouth, Philip stepped forward and shouted, "Stop!" The man raised his axe. Philip rushed at him. The man swung the axe, but Philip pushed him at the last minute. The blade of the axe clanged on the stone pavement a foot from the victim's head. The attacker recovered his balance and stared at Philip in amazement. Philip stared back at him, trying not to tremble, wishing he could remember a word or two of Welsh. Before either of them moved, the other two pursuers caught up, and one of them cannoned into Philip, sending him sprawling. That probably saved his life, he realized a moment later. When he recovered, everyone had forgotten him. They were butchering the poor young man on the ground with unbelievable savagery. Philip scrambled to his feet, but he was already too late. Their hammers and axes were thudding into a corpse. He looked up at the sky and shouted angrily, "If I can't save anyone, why did you send me here?" As if in reply, he heard a scream from a nearby house. It was a one-story building of stone and wood, not as costly as those around it. The door stood open. Philip ran inside. There were two rooms with an arch between and straw on the floor. A woman with two small children huddled in a corner, terrified. Three men-at-arms were in the middle of the house, confronting one small, bald man. A young woman of about 18 years was on the floor. Her dress was ripped, and one of the three men-at-arms was kneeling on her chest, holding her thighs apart. The bald man was clearly trying to stop them from raping his daughter. As Philip came in, the father flung himself at one of the men-at-arms. The soldier threw him off. The father staggered back. The soldier plunged his sword into the father's abdomen. The woman in the corner screamed like a lost soul. Philip yelled, "Stop!" They all looked at him as if he were mad. In his most authoritative voice he said, "You'll all go to hell if you do this." The one who had killed the father raised his sword to strike Philip.
"Just a minute," said the man on the ground, still holding the girl's legs. "Who are you, monk?"
"I am Philip of Gwynedd, prior of Kingsbridge, and I command you, in God's name, to leave that girl alone if you care for your immortal souls."
"A prior? I thought so," said the man on the ground. "He's worth a ransom."
The first man sheathed his sword and said, "Get over in the corner with the woman where you belong." Philip said, "Don't lay hands on a monk's robes." He was trying to sound dangerous, but he could hear the note of desperation in his voice.
"Take him to the castle, John," said the man on the ground, who was still sitting on the girl. He seemed to be the leader.
"Go to hell," said John. "I want to fuck her first."
He grabbed Philip's arms, and before Philip could resist, flung him into the corner. Philip tumbled onto the floor beside the mother. The man called John lifted the front of his tunic and fell on the girl. The mother turned her head aside and began to sob. Philip said, "I'll not watch this." He stood up and grabbed the rapist by the hair, pulling him off the girl. The rapist roared with pain. The third man raised a club. Philip saw the blow coming, but he was too late. The club landed on his head. He felt a moment of agonizing pain. Then everything went black, and he lost consciousness before he hit the ground. The prisoners were taken to the castle and locked in cages. These were stout wooden structures like miniature houses, 6 feet long and 3 feet wide, and only a little higher than a man's head. Instead of solid walls, they had close-spaced vertical posts, which enabled the jailer to see inside.
In normal times, when they were used to confine thieves and murderers and heretics, there would be only one or two people to a cage. Today, the rebels put 8 or 10 in each, and still there were more prisoners. The surplus captives were tied together with ropes and herded into a corner of the compound. They could have escaped fairly easily, but they did not, probably because they were safer here than outside in the town. Philip sat in one corner of a cage, nursing a splitting headache, feeling a fool and a failure. In the end he had been as useless as the cowardly Bishop Alexander. He had not saved a single life. He had not even prevented one blow. The citizens of Lincoln would have been no worse off without him. Unlike Abbot Peter, he had been powerless to stop the violence. "I'm just not the man Father Peter was," he thought. Worse still, in his vain attempt to help the townspeople, he had probably thrown away his chance of winning concessions from the Empress Maud when she became queen. He was now a prisoner of her army. It would be assumed, therefore, that he had been with King Stephen's forces. Kingsbridge Priory would have to pay a ransom for Philip's release. It was quite likely that the whole thing would come to Maud's notice, and then she would be prejudiced against Philip. He felt sick, disappointed, and full of remorse. More prisoners were brought in through the day. The influx ended around nightfall, but the sacking of the city went on outside the castle walls. Philip could hear the shouts and screams and sounds of destruction. Toward midnight the noise died down, presumably as the soldiers became so drunk on stolen wine and sated with rape and violence that they could do no more damage. A few of them staggered into the castle, boasting of their triumphs, quarrelling among themselves and vomiting on the grass, and eventually fell down insensible and slept. Philip slept too, although he did not have enough room to lie down and had to slump in the corner with his back against the wooden bars of his cage. He woke at dawn, shivering with cold, but the pain in his head had softened, mercifully, to a dull ache. He stood up to stretch his legs and slapped his arms against his sides to warm himself. All the castle buildings were overflowing with people. The open-fronted stables revealed men sleeping in the stalls, while the horses were tied up outside. Pairs of legs stuck out of the bakehouse door and the kitchen undercroft. The small minority of sober soldiers had pitched tents. There were horses everywhere. In the southeast corner of the castle compound was the keep, a castle within a castle, built on a high mound, its mighty stone walls encircling half a dozen or more wooden buildings. The earls and knights of the winning side would be in there, sleeping off their own celebration. Philip's mind turned to the implications of yesterday's battle. Did it mean the war was over? Probably. Stephen had a wife, Queen Matilda, who might fight on. She was Countess of Boulogne, and with her French knights she had taken Dover Castle early in the war, and now controlled much of Kent on her husband's behalf. However, she would find it difficult to gather support from the barons while Stephen was in prison. She might hold on to Kent for a while, but she was unlikely to make any gains. Nevertheless, Maud's problems were not yet over. She had to consolidate her military victory, gain the approval of the church, and be crowned at Westminster. However, given determination and a little wisdom, she would probably succeed. And this was good news for Kingsbridge, or it would be if Philip could get out of here without being branded a supporter of Stephen. There was no sun, but the air warmed a little as the day got brighter. Philip's fellow prisoners awoke gradually, groaning with aches and pains. Most of them had been at least bruised, and they felt worse after a cold night, with only the minimal shelter of the roof and bars of the cage. Some were wealthy citizens, and others were knights who had been captured in battle. When most of them were awake, Philip asked, "Did anyone see what happened to Richard of Kingsbridge?" He was hoping Richard had survived, for Aliena's sake. A man with a blood-stained bandage around his head said, "He fought like a lion. He rallied the townsmen when things got bad. Did he live or die?" The man shook his wounded head slowly. "I didn't see him at the end. What about William Hamley?" It would be a blessed relief if William had fallen. "He was with the king for most of the battle, but he got away at the end. I saw him on a horse flying across the field, well ahead of the pack." Ah. The faint hope faded. Philip's problems were not to be solved that easily.
The conversation lapsed, and the cage fell silent. Outside, the soldiers were on the move, nursing their hangovers, checking their booty, making sure their hostages were still in captivity, and getting breakfast from the kitchen. Philip wondered where the prisoners got fed. They must, he thought, for otherwise they would die and there would be no ransoms. But who would take the responsibility for feeding all these people? That started him wondering how long he would be here. His captors would have to send a message to Kingsbridge demanding a ransom. The brothers would send one of their number to negotiate his release. Who would it be? Milius would be the best, but Remigius, who as sub-prior was in charge in Philip's absence, might send one of his cronies, or even come himself. Remigius would do everything slowly. He was incapable of prompt and decisive action, even in his own interest. It could take months. Philip became gloomier. Other prisoners were luckier. Soon after sunrise, wives and children and relatives of the captives began to trickle into the castle, fearfully and hesitantly at first, then with more confidence, to negotiate the ransom of their loved ones. They would bargain with the captors for a while, protesting their lack of money, offering cheap jewelry or other valuables. Then they would reach an agreement, depart, and return a little later with whatever ransom had been agreed, usually cash. The piles of booty grew higher, and the cages emptied out. By midday, half the prisoners had gone. They were the local people, Philip assumed. Those remaining must be from distant towns, and were probably all knights who had been taken during the battle. This impression was confirmed when the constable of the castle came around the cages and asked the names of everyone remaining. Most of them were knights from the south. Philip noticed that in one of the cages there was only one man, and he was confined in stocks, as if someone wanted to be doubly sure he could not escape. After staring at the special prisoner for a few minutes, Philip realized who it was. "Look," he said to the three men in his own cage, "that man on his own. Is it who I think it is?" The others looked. "By Christ, it's the king," said one, and the others agreed. Philip stared at the muddy, tawny-haired man with his hands and feet confined uncomfortably in the wooden vice of the stocks. He looked just like all the rest of them. Yesterday he had been king of England. Yesterday he had refused Kingsbridge a market license. Today he could not stand up without someone else's leave. The king had got his just deserts, but all the same Philip felt sorry for him. Early in the afternoon the prisoners were given food. It was lukewarm leftovers from the dinner provided for the fighting men, but they fell on it ravenously. Philip hung back and let the others have most of it, for he regarded hunger as a base weakness that ought to be resisted from time to time, and considered any enforced fast to be an opportunity to mortify the flesh. While they were scraping the bowl, there was a flurry of activity over at the keep, and a group of earls came out. As they walked down the steps of the keep and across the castle compound, Philip observed that two of them went a little in front of the others, and were treated with deference. They had to be Ranulph of Chester and Robert of Gloucester, but Philip did not know which was which. They approached Stephen's cage. "Good day, cousin Robert," Stephen said, heavily emphasizing the word cousin. The taller of the two men replied, "I didn't intend for you to spend the night in the stocks. I ordered that you be moved, but the order wasn't obeyed. However, you seem to have survived." A man in priest's clothing detached himself from the group and came toward Philip's cage. At first, Philip paid him no attention, for Stephen was asking what was to be done with him, and Philip wanted to hear the answer. But the priest said, "Which one of you is the prior of Kingsbridge?" "I am," Philip said. The priest spoke to one of the men-at-arms who had brought Philip here. "Release that man." Philip was mystified. He had never seen the priest in his life. Clearly his name had been picked out of the list compiled earlier by the castle constable. But why? He would be glad to get out of the cage, but he was not ready to rejoice. He did not know what was in store for him. The man-at-arms protested, "He's my prisoner." "Not any more," said the priest. "Let him go." "Why should I release him without a ransom?"
the man said belligerently. The priest replied equally forcefully. First, because he's neither a fighting man in the king's army nor a citizen of this town, so you have committed a crime by imprisoning him. Second, because he's a monk, and you are guilty of sacrilege by laying hands on a man of God. Third, because Queen Maud's secretary says you have to release him, and if you refuse, you'll end up inside that cage yourself, faster than you can blink. So jump to it! All right, the man grumbled. Philip was dismayed. He had been nursing a faint hope that Maud would never get to know of his imprisonment here. If Maud's secretary had asked to see him, that hope was now dashed. Feeling as if he had hit rock bottom, he stepped out of the cage. "Come with me," said the priest. Philip followed him. "Am I to be set free?" he said. "I imagine so." The priest looked surprised by the question. "Don't you know whom you're going to see?" "I haven't an inkling." The priest smiled. "I'll let him surprise you." They crossed the compound to the keep and climbed the long flight of steps that led up to the mound to the gate. Philip racked his brains but could not guess why a secretary of Maud's should have an interest in him. He followed the priest through the gate. The circular stone keep was lined with two-story houses built against the wall. In the middle was a tiny courtyard with a well. The priest led Philip into one of the houses. Inside the house was another priest, standing in front of the fire with his back to the door. He had the same build as Philip, short and slight, and the same black hair, but his head was not shaved and his hair was not graying. It was a very familiar back. Philip could hardly believe his luck. A broad grin spread across his face. The priest turned. He had bright blue eyes just like Philip's, and he, too, was grinning. He held out his arms. "Philip," he said. "Well, God be praised," Philip said in astonishment. "Francis." The two brothers embraced, and Philip's eyes filled with tears. 3. The royal reception hall at Winchester Castle looked very different. The dogs had gone, and so had King Stephen's plain wooden throne, the benches and the animal skins from the walls. Instead, there were embroidered hangings, richly coloured carpets, bowls of sweetmeats, and painted chairs. The room smelled of flowers. Philip was never at ease at the royal court, and a feminine royal court was enough to put him in a state of quivering anxiety. The Empress Maud was his only hope of getting the quarry back and reopening the market, but he had no confidence that this haughty, willful woman would make a just decision. The Empress sat on a delicately carved, gilded throne, wearing a dress the colour of bluebells. She was tall and thin, with proud dark eyes and straight, glossy black hair. Over her gown she wore a pelisse, a knee-length silk coat with a tight waist and flared skirt, a style that had not been seen in England until she arrived, but was now much imitated. She had been married to her first husband for 11 years and her second for 14, but she still looked less than 40 years old. People raved about her beauty. To Philip she looked rather angular and unfriendly, but he was a poor judge of feminine attraction, being more or less immune to it. Philip, Francis, William Hamley, and Bishop Walleran bowed to her and stood waiting. She ignored them for a while and continued talking to a lady-in-waiting. The conversation seemed to be rather trifling, for they both laughed prettily, but Maud did not interrupt it to greet her visitors. Francis worked closely with her and saw her almost every day, but they were not great friends. Her brother Robert, Francis's former employer, had given him to her when she arrived in England, because she needed a first-class secretary. However, this was not the only motive. Francis acted as link-man between brother and sister and kept an eye on the impetuous Maud. It was nothing for brothers and sisters to betray one another in the treacherous life of the royal court, and Francis's real role was to make it difficult for Maud to do anything underhand. Maud knew this and accepted it, but her relationship with Francis was nevertheless an uneasy one. It was 2 months since the Battle of Lincoln, and in that time all had gone well for Maud. Bishop Henry had welcomed her to Winchester, thereby betraying his brother, King Stephen, and had convened a great council of bishops and abbots which had elected her queen,
and she was now negotiating with the Commune of London to arrange her coronation at Westminster. King David of Scotland, who happened to be her uncle, was on his way to pay her a formal royal visit, one sovereign to another. Bishop Henry was strongly supported by Bishop Walleran of Kingsbridge, and according to Francis, Walleran had persuaded William Hamley to switch sides and pledge allegiance to Maud. Now William had come for his reward. The four men stood waiting, William with his backer Bishop Walleran, and Prior Philip with his sponsor, Francis. This was the first time Philip had set eyes on Maud. Her appearance did not reassure him. Despite her regal air, he thought she looked flighty. When Maud finished chatting, she turned to them with a triumphant look, as if to say, "See how unimportant you are. Even my lady-in-waiting has priority over you." She looked at Philip steadily for a few moments, until he became embarrassed. Then she said, "Well, Francis, have you brought me your twin?" Francis said, "My brother Philip, lady, the prior of Kingsbridge." Philip bowed again and said, "Somewhat too old and grey to be a twin, lady." It was the kind of trivial, self-deprecating remark the courtiers seemed to find amusing, but she gave him a frozen look and ignored it. He decided to abandon any attempt to be charming. She turned to William. "And Sir William Hamley, who fought bravely against my army at the Battle of Lincoln, but has now seen the error of his ways." William bowed and wisely kept his mouth shut. She turned back to Philip. "You ask me to grant you a license to hold a market?"
"Yes, m'lady."
Francis said, "The income from the market will all be spent on building the cathedral, lady."
"On what day of the week do you want to hold your market?"
she asked.
"A Sunday."
She raised her plucked eyebrows.
"You holy men are generally opposed to Sunday markets. Don't they keep people from church?"
"Not in our case," Philip said. "People come to labor on the building and attend a service, and they do their buying and selling as well."
"So you're already holding this market?" she said sharply.
Philip realized he had blundered. He felt like kicking himself. Francis rescued him.
"No, lady, they are not holding the market at present," he said. "It began informally, but Prior Philip ordered it to cease until he was granted a license."
That was the truth, but not the whole truth. However, Maud seemed to accept it. Philip silently prayed for forgiveness for Francis. Maud said, "Is there no other market in the area?" William spoke up. "Yes, there is, at Shiring, and the Kingsbridge market has been taking business away." Philip said, "But Shiring is 20 miles from Kingsbridge." Francis said, "My lady, the rule is that markets must be at least 14 miles apart. By that criterion, Kingsbridge and Shiring do not compete." She nodded, apparently willing to accept Francis's ruling on a point of law. So far, thought Philip, it's going our way. Maud said, "You also ask for the right to take stone from the Earl of Shiring's quarry." "We have had the right for many years, but William lately threw out our quarrymen, killing 5.
"Who gave you the right to take stone?"
she interrupted.
"King Stephen, the usurper."
Francis hastily said, "My lady, Prior Philip naturally accepts that all edicts of the pretender Stephen are invalid unless ratified by you." Philip accepted no such thing, but he saw that it would be unwise to say so. William blurted out, "I closed the quarry in retaliation for his illegal market." It was amazing, Philip thought, how a clear case of injustice could come to seem evenly balanced when argued at the court. Maud said, "This entire squabble came about because Stephen's original ruling was foolish." Bishop Walleran spoke for the first time.
"There, lady, I heartily agree with you," he said oilily.
"It was asking for trouble to give the quarry to one person but let another mine it," she said. "The quarry must belong to one or the other."
That was true, Philip thought, and if she were to follow the spirit of Stephen's original ruling, it would belong to Kingsbridge. She went on,
"My decision is that it shall belong to my noble ally, Sir William."
Philip's heart sank. The cathedral building could not have come on so well without free access to that quarry. It would have to slow right down while Philip tried to find the money to buy stone, and all because of the whim of this capricious woman. It made him fume. William said, "Thank you, lady." Maud said,
However, Kingsbridge shall have market rights, as at Shiring.
Philip's spirits rose again. The market would not quite pay for the stone, but it was a big help. It meant he would be scraping around for money again, just as he had at the beginning, but he could carry on. Maud had given each one a part of what he wanted. Perhaps she was not so empty-headed after all. Francis said, "Market rights as at Shiring, lady."
"That's what I said."
Philip was not sure why Francis had repeated it. It was common for licenses to refer to the rights enjoyed by another town. It was even-handed and saved writing. Philip would have to check exactly what Shiring's charter said. There might be restrictions or extra privileges. Maud said, "So you have both got something. William gets the quarry and Prior Philip gets the market. And in return, each of you will pay me £100. That is all." She turned away. Philip was flabbergasted. £100? The priory did not have 100 pennies at the moment. How was he to raise this money? The market would take years to earn £100. It was a devastating blow that would set the building program back permanently. He stood staring at Maud, but she was apparently deep in conversation with her lady-in-waiting again. Francis nudged him. Philip opened his mouth to speak. Francis held a finger to his lips. Philip said, "But Francis," shook his head urgently. Philip knew Francis was right. He let his shoulders slump in defeat. Helplessly, he turned away and walked out of the royal presence. Francis was impressed when Philip showed him around Kingsbridge Priory. "I was here 10 years ago, and it was a dump," he said irreverently. "You've really brought it to life." He was very taken with the writing room, which Tom had finished while Philip was in London. A small building next to the chapter house, it had large windows, a fireplace with a chimney, a row of writing desks, and a big oak cupboard for the books. 4 of the brothers were at work there already, standing at the high desks, writing on parchment sheets with quill pens. 3 were copying, 1 the Psalms of David, 1 St. Matthew's Gospel, and 1 the Rule of St. Benedict. In addition, Brother Timothy was writing a history of England, although as he had begun with the creation of the world, Philip was afraid the old boy might never finish it. The writing room was small. Philip had not wanted to divert much stone from the cathedral, but it was a warm, dry, well-lit place, just what was needed. "The priory has disgracefully few books, and as they're iniquitously expensive to buy, this is the only way to build our collection," Philip explained. In the undercroft was a workshop where an old monk was teaching 2 youngsters how to stretch the skin of a sheep for parchment, how to make ink, and how to bind the sheets into a book. Francis said, "You'll be able to sell books, too." "Oh, yes, the writing room will pay for itself many times over." They left the building and walked through the cloisters. It was the study hour. Most of the monks were reading. A few were meditating, an activity that was suspiciously similar to dozing, as Francis remarked skeptically. In the northwest corner were 20 schoolboys reciting Latin verbs. Philip stopped and pointed. "See the little boy at the end of the bench?" Francis said, "Writing on a slate with his tongue sticking out. That's the baby you found in the forest." "But he's so big! 5 1/2 years old and precocious." Francis shook his head in wonderment. "Time goes by so fast. How is he?" "He's spoiled by the monks, but he'll survive. You and I did." "Who are the other pupils?" "Either novice monks or the sons of merchants and local gentry learning to write and figure." They left the cloisters and passed on to the building site. The eastern limb of the new cathedral was now more than half built. The great double row of mighty columns was 40 feet high, and all the arches in between had been completed. Above the arcade, the tribune gallery was taking shape. Either side of the arcade, the lower walls of the aisle had been built, with their out-jutting buttresses. As they walked around, Philip saw that the masons were constructing the half-arches that would connect the tops of those buttresses with the top of the tribune gallery, allowing the buttresses to take the weight of the roof. Francis was almost awestruck. "You've done all this, Philip," he said. "The writing room, the school, the new church, even all these new houses in the town. It's all come about because you made it happen." Philip was touched. No one had ever said that to him. If asked,
He would say that God had blessed his efforts. But in his heart of hearts he knew that what Francis said was true. This thriving, busy town was his creation. Recognition gave him a warm glow, especially coming as it did from his sophisticated, cynical younger brother. Tom Builder saw them and came over.
"You've made marvelous progress," Philip said to him.
"Yes, but look at that." Tom pointed to the northeast corner of the Priory Close, where stone from the quarry was stockpiled. There were normally hundreds of stones stacked in rows, but now there were only about 25 scattered on the ground. "Unfortunately, our marvelous progress means we've used up our stock of stone." Philip's elation evaporated. Everything he had achieved here was at risk, because of Maud's harsh ruling. They walked along the north side of the site where the most skilled masons were working at their benches, carving the stones into shape with hammers and chisels. Philip stopped behind one craftsman and studied his work. It was a capital, the large jutting-out stone that always stood on top of a column. Using a light hammer and a small chisel, the mason was carving a pattern of leaves on the capital. The leaves were deeply undercut, and the work was delicate. To Philip's surprise, he saw that the craftsman was young Jack, Tom's stepson.
"I thought Jack was still a learner," he said.
"He is." Tom moved on, and when they were out of earshot, he said, "The boy is remarkable. There are men here who have been carving stone since before he was born, and none of them can match his work." He gave a slightly embarrassed laugh. "And he isn't even my own son." Tom's real son, Alfred, was a master mason, and had his own gang of apprentices and labours. But Philip knew that Alfred and his gang did not do the delicate work. Philip wondered how Tom felt about that in his heart. Tom's mind had returned to the problem of paying for the market license.
"Surely the market will bring in a lot of money," he said.
"Yes, but not enough. It should raise about £50 a year at the start." Tom nodded gloomily. "That will just about pay for the stone."
"We could manage if I didn't have to pay Maud £100.
"What about the wool?" The wool that was piling up in Philip's barns would be sold at the Shiring Fleece Fair in a few weeks' time, and would fetch about £100.
"That's what I'm going to use to pay Maud. But then I'll have nothing left for the craftsman's wages for the next 12 months.
"Can't you borrow?"
"I already have. The Jews won't lend me any more. I asked while I was in Winchester. They won't lend you money if they don't think you can pay it back."
"What about Aliena?" Philip was startled. He had never thought of borrowing from her. She had even more wool in her barns. After the fleece fair, she might have £200.
"But she needs the money to make her living, and Christians can't charge interest. If she lent her money to me, she would have nothing to trade with."
"Although..." Even as he spoke, he was turning over a new idea. He remembered that Aliena had wanted to buy his entire wool production for the year. Perhaps they could work something out.
"I think I'll talk to her anyway," he said. "Is she at home at the moment?"
"I think so. I saw her this morning."
"Come, Francis. You're about to meet a remarkable young woman."
They left Tom and hurried out of the close into the town. Aliena had two houses side by side up against the west wall of the priory. She lived in one and used the other as a barn. She was very wealthy. There had to be a way she could help the priory pay Maud's extortionate fee for the market license. A vague idea was taking shape in Philip's mind. Aliena was in the barn, supervising the unloading of an ox cart stacked high with sacks of wool. She wore a brocade pelisse, like the one the Empress Maud had worn, and her hair was done up in a white linen coif. She looked authoritative, as always, and the two men unloading the cart obeyed her instructions without question. Everyone respected her, although, strangely, she had no close friends. She greeted Philip warmly.
"When we heard about the Battle of Lincoln, we were afraid you might have been killed," she said.
There was real concern in her eyes, and Philip was moved to think that people had worried about him. He introduced her to Francis.
"Did you get justice at Winchester?" Aliena asked.
"Not exactly," Philip replied. "The Empress Maud granted us a market, but denied us the quarry. The one more or less compensates for the other, but she charged me £100 for the market license." Aliena was shocked.
"That's terrible. Did you tell her the income from the market goes to the cathedral building?"
"Oh, yes. but where will you find 100 pounds? I thought you might be able to help.
Me?
Aliena was taken aback. In a few weeks' time, after you've sold your wool to the Flemish, you'll have 200 pounds or more.
Aliena looked troubled. And I'd give it to you, gladly, but I need it to buy more wool next year.
Remember you wanted to buy my wool?
Yes, but it's too late now. I wanted to buy it early in the season. Besides, you can sell it yourself soon.
I was thinking, Philip said, could I sell you next year's wool?
She frowned.
But you haven't got it. Could I sell it to you before I've got it?
I don't see how.
Simple. You give me the money now, I give you the wool next year.
Aliena clearly did not know how to take this proposal. It was unlike any known way of doing business. It was new to Philip, too. He had just made it up.
Aliena spoke slowly and thoughtfully.
I would have to offer you a slightly lower price than you could get by waiting.
Moreover, the price of wool might go up between now and next summer. It has every year I've been in the business.
So I lose a little, and you gain a little, Philip said. But I'll be able to carry on building for another year.
And what will you do next year?
I don't know. Perhaps I'll sell you the following year's wool.
Aliena nodded.
It makes sense.
Philip took her hands and looked into her eyes.
If you do this, Aliena, you'll save the cathedral, he said fervently.
Aliena looked very solemn.
You saved me once, didn't you?
I did.
Then I'll do the same for you.
God bless you!
In an excess of gratitude, he hugged her. Then he remembered she was a woman and detached himself hastily.
I don't know how to thank you, he said. I was at my wit's end.
Aliena laughed. I'm not sure I deserve this much gratitude. I'll probably do very well out of the arrangement.
I hope so.
Let's drink a cup of wine together to seal the bargain, she said. I'll just pay the carter. The ox cart was empty and the wool stacked neatly. Philip and Francis stepped outside while Aliena settled up with the carter. The sun was going down and the building workers were walking back to their homes. Philip's elation returned. He had found a way to carry on despite all the setbacks.
Thank God for Aliena, he said.
You didn't tell me she was so beautiful, Francis said.
Beautiful? I suppose she is.
Francis laughed.
Philip, you're blind! She's one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen! She's enough to make a man give up the priesthood.
Philip looked sharply at Francis.
You ought not to talk like that.
Sorry.
Aliena came out and locked the barn. Then they went into her home. It was a large house with a main room and a separate bedroom. There was a beer barrel in the corner, a whole ham hanging from the ceiling, and a white linen cloth on the table. A middle-aged woman servant poured wine from a flask into silver goblets for the guests. Aliena lived comfortably.
If she's so beautiful, Philip wondered, why hasn't she got a husband?
There was no shortage of aspirants. She had been courted by every eligible young man in the county, but she had turned them all down. He felt so grateful to her that he wanted her to be happy. Her mind was still on practicalities. I won't have the money until after the Shiring Fleece Fair, she said when they had toasted their agreement. Philip turned to Francis.
Will Maud wait?
How long?
The fair is 3 weeks from Thursday.
Francis nodded.
I'll tell her. She'll wait.
Aliena untied her headdress and shook out her curly, dark hair. She gave a tired sigh.
The days are too short, she said. I can't get everything done.
I want to buy more wool, but I've got to find enough carters to take it all to Shiring.
Philip said, and next year you'll have even more.
I wish we could make the Flemish come here to buy.
It would be so much easier for us than taking all our wool to Shiring. Francis interjected.
But you can.
They both looked at him. Philip said,
How?
Hold your own fleece fair.
Philip began to see what he was driving at.
Can we?
Maud gave you exactly the same rights as Shiring. I wrote your charter myself.
If Shiring can hold a fleece fair,
so can you.
Aliena said,
Why, that would be wonderful.
We wouldn't have to cart all these sacks to Shiring. We could do the business here and ship the wool directly to Flanders.
That's the least of it, Philip said excitedly.
A fleece fair makes as much in a week as a Sunday market makes in a whole year. We can't do it this year, of course. Nobody will know about it. But we can spread the news at this year's Shiring Fleece Fair,